Welcome to the War in Ukraine update from Kyiv podcast. I'm Jessica Ganawa, a lecturer in international relations at Flinders University in Australia, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Melissa Desvart. Melissa is a professor of digital technology, security and governance at Flinders University and specialises in space law, a domain that has been relevant as we've been watching the conflict in Ukraine unfold. So I'm really excited to discuss some aspects that are associated with the domain of space law with Melissa today. So thanks so much for joining me today, Melissa.
No problem, Jessica. Happy to be here.
Following the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February this year, and then the quite strong response to that from Western countries in imposing sanctions on Russia, and we had this intensification of tension in those relations. We also saw the Russian space chief, Dmitry Rogozin, threaten to pull Russia out from international space cooperation. For me, as a total layperson, knowing nothing about the space domain, watching that, it seemed like quite an extreme statement to make. But I wanted to get your reflection on that. How serious a move was that in terms of the future of space cooperation?
So Rogozin is pretty well known for his sort of volatile public statements. So, I mean, there's been a bit of debate really about how serious he was, whether it was, you know, probably what we'd call sort of saber rattling or not. And in fact, he has since essentially locked up the tweets that he made behind a sort of private account. So, but there's certainly been a Twitter war between him and Scott Kelly, who was one of the longest serving American astronauts on the ISS, the International Space Station. But I suppose it's important from the point of view of really highlighting for people the importance maybe more of the International Space Station as a successful international peaceful use of space. You know, the fact that it has continued for as long as it has continued. And in fact, the fact that from 2011 up until only very recently, the US was entirely dependent on the Russian Soyuz program to get its astronauts up and back to the ISS is really a unique scenario. So, you know, how serious was it? Well, the ISS is coming to an end. It's due, I think, officially to finish about by the end of 2024, although the Americans have said that they want it extended till 2030. You know, the US is off exploring other programs to do with the Lunar Gateway and the Artemis program that Russia is not part of. And that's a point of tension as well. So I think what it says is really there is tension and there's a need to really monitor how we can continue to include Russia in international discussions about the peaceful uses of outer space.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And you're right. It is so striking that there seems to be this relatively successful or at least consistent cooperation when we're looking at the space domain. Are there any legal constraints that would stop a country from withdrawing from cooperation with other countries?
Yeah, so people often think about space as being a very lawless domain, but in fact, there is quite a lot of law. There are five UN space treaties. Four of them are well subscribed. One of them is not at all. But certainly the fundamental one of those, the Outer Space Treaty, was really concluded as what I always think of as an arms control treaty. I mean, mm-hmm. Russia or the USSR as it then was, and the US at that time recognized that the detonation of weapons of mass destruction in the orbit of the Earth was going to be an incredibly devastating and harmful thing. And I think the Outer Space Treaty was really predicated on that understanding, the need to stop the use or the deployment of nukes in space. And so cooperation really evolved from that understanding that space is a domain that is quite fragile and one in which the whole Earth is dependent on. So the ISS, which was part of that recognition, once the US had made it to the moon, there was a dwindling of interest because, of course, the space race really was about firsts. Who could put the first person in space, the first orbit of space, the first person on the moon, that sort of thing, direction turned to low Earth orbit. And the ISS is a successful exemplar of that. And the ISS, of course, is governed by the Intergovernmental Agreement and a number of subsidiary international agreements, which is a great, again, a great model of how nation states can agree to cooperate in the space environment. At the moment, we have the open-ended working group of the UN on the development of space norms. And this is a recognition of the fact that the discussion of the peaceful uses of outer space or the prevention of an arms race in outer space process in the UN had essentially stalled because of the fact that you had Russia and China taking a particular approach, the EU taking another approach, the US taking a different approach, and there was a need to step away from sort of formal treaty or code of conduct creation to really discussing norms. But of course, now with the sanctions imposed on Russia, you have, you know, an impact on the open-ended working group because of Russia's, you know, participation in that group. So yes, we have laws, we have norms, but we also have politics that are really impacting on the ability to sort of formalize even what we call sort of soft law understandings about how we should conduct ourselves in space. But a growing recognition that that's going to be vital, because without it, we're not going to even be able to access space.
Mm, interesting. And like, I guess, many other areas of international law, hard to have those really hard enforcement mechanisms if we don't have buy-in from actors that are involved. What do you think it is about the space domain that we have seen relatively successful cooperation? I know with tensions and not always smooth and not always easy, but what is it about the particularities of the space domain, do you think? What factors might account for the fact that states have relatively managed to cooperate even when politically things have been quite fractious between them on Earth?
Wow, that's a big question.
A big question.
I can only reflect on it, you know, from my own personal point of view, but I think that part of it is because of that recognition that, you know, if space becomes a place of conflict, particularly nuclear conflict, then the impact on Earth would be devastating. So that overarching, you know, recognition of mutually assured destruction is a pretty powerful motivator. I think another part of that was the establishment in the space treaties that astronauts are somehow kind of special people. So the concept of astronaut is dealt with differently under international law, and there's an obligation to rescue and return astronauts. But I think there is something particular too about being in space. It's a very, very dangerous environment. It's a very fragile environment. And I think if you read any of the stories of the cosmonauts and the astronauts and others who have lived and worked on the space station, it really is a great experiment of teaching you in this very harsh environment how to cooperate, to get along, to be involved in scientific experiments. I mean, it's a very small, confined space. You can't wash. There's not a lot of privacy. and particularly because the US was dependent on Russia for getting astronauts to and from the space station, all of the astronauts had to learn to speak Russian. I mean, they might seem banal, they might seem minor things, but they're also the very things that bring people together. You know, science, difficult mm-hmm. conditions, being able to speak the same language, living closely together, recognizing that what you do is important for the whole of humanity, sitting in a tin can, looking down at the blue Earth. I think those things can be fairly powerful motivators for bringing people together.
Mm, yeah, that makes sense. And interesting that the risks or the threat are coming there from the external environment, but not from other humans. So we've got some difference there in drawing people together against that externally sort of fragile and uncertain environment in which the astronauts are located. So moving to a slightly different issue now, since the 24th of February and the current phase of the war in Ukraine, we had this quite striking call from President Zelensky, I believe tweeting out to Elon Musk saying, "Hey, Elon, we need internet. Can you help us?" And Elon Musk tweeting back saying, "Yeah, no worries, Zelensky. My Starlink satellites are coming." And this was fascinating because we're really seeing a private sector actor who is involved in the space domain supplying internet coverage for a sovereign state. We know that those Starlink satellites did arrive to Ukraine. Can you explain for listeners, how does this actually work?
Yes. So Elon, the great disruptor, and I suppose I should also say that the factor that has meant that the US is no longer reliant on Russia for getting its astronauts to and from the International Space Station is also Elon Musk, because he's able to provide crewed missions to the space station. So that was disruption number one. Disruption number two, of course, is his low Earth orbit constellations of satellites. So because of the development of low Earth orbit satellites, they're cheaper to get into space. They sit at a much lower orbit from Earth. You know, traditionally, we think of satellites probably sitting out in geostationary or geosynchronous orbit, which is about 35, 36,000 kilometers from Earth. Low Earth orbit is about 1,600 kilometers. And of course, the space station also sits in low Earth orbit. So it's cheaper to get satellites into space. And that means you can deploy more and you can deploy them faster. So there's about, I think, 2,000 low Earth orbit satellites that Starlink are currently operating. And apparently there's about 10,000 Starlink terminals that have been deployed to the Ukraine. But, you know, we can't be 100% positive about what that is. So really what it's providing is fast broadband. And so prior to Ukraine, you know, Starlink internet connection was used by people, or was touted as being useful for people largely in remote areas. So we know in Australia, we use fiber, we use, you know, broadband connections are largely still by maybe even by copper, but fiber to the home. Whereas the use of LEO means you're not dependent on cable, you're not dependent on the physical infrastructure. So it means by way of these receivers, you can have low cost and quite fast internet. Why is it important? It's because it's not dependent on physical cable-like infrastructure is the best way to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And how much of an unprecedented move is this, that a private sector actor is guaranteeing internet connectivity for a nation state during a time of war, which given the sort of information war that's going on and how much that depends on having good internet access, which Ukraine has clearly had this entire time, you're potentially engaging with geopolitical or geostrategic concerns with that move.
I think it is a game changer, really, and particularly where you have an entity, you know, like Starlink, which is very much, seems very much to be controlled by one person. So the decision can be made quite rapidly. You will have internet. And of course, that internet is being deployed both to the civilian and the military uses in Ukraine. So not only is it unprecedented in terms of the capacity to deploy that facility. And again, we've come to think of internet as being an essential service in the same way that we think of electricity or water. So it's not just a sort of a commercial service. It's a fundamental a need that people have on a daily basis. The fact that it's able to shift so quickly. So there were reports of there being a jamming attack being mounted on the Starlink satellites early on, and they just quickly moved to reconfigure the software within the Starlink system to prevent that attack. And there was even statements made about, you know, whether nation states are capable of making decisions to move that quickly on reconfiguring the provision of services that could be done in the same way. So it is a very unusual move.
And I'm wondering about the further implications of this as well. Like when I saw that, you know, Elon Musk has put his Starlink satellites over Ukraine, I was quite pleased that Ukraine wasn't going to lose access to internet during this very critical time. But what do you think about further implications for national security, for state sovereignty, if we're seeing a situation where a private sector actor has the power to control internet connectivity for an entire country?
So I suppose this is one of the broader issues that we should be facing now as we move into a world where we are entirely dependent on on communications infrastructure. We're so reliant on the internet, on GPS for everything. I mean, most people don't stop to think about what a day without space would be like. But I mean, it would mean that the banks stopped working. It would mean that the traffic lights stopped working. It would mean that we couldn't have delivery of Uber. We couldn't have delivery via Amazon. So to be able to continue to provide that fundamental service is a very profound one. The concern, of course, goes both ways. You know, should we be reliant upon a commercial provider for that sort of a service? But if you are also the commercial provider, have you understood the potential for making yourself a legitimate military target for providing that service? So there's some really interesting questions, really, you know, concerning questions about how vulnerable we are to service providers of these sorts of services. Because, you know, you could put the question the other way and say, well, what if Starlink decided that it no longer wished to provide those services because it was, you know, commercially too risky or it couldn't afford to do so? To then the point about, you know, concerns that were raised about both the satellites themselves being targetable, or even, you know, there were warnings made too when the dishes were deployed about the fact that they shouldn't be made, they're quite distinctive, and that people should take care not to place them anywhere too obvious because they may then be targetable from Russian attack as well. So once you place yourself in a situation where international humanitarian law might apply to you, the stakes become so much higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess in some ways, those lines between what I'm calling sort of private sector and government sector have always been a little more blurry, and there's more of a network of engagement than perhaps I was making out in posing the question. I mean, to me, it is fascinating, as you said, that it's really also not just one company, but almost one individual. And that seems something that we need to consider, and consider what it means and, you know, what kind of framework we might need to govern that space going forward, which I'm sure people in the space domain are already considering. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Melissa, and thanks for providing your insights into these issues. I really appreciate it.
No worries. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Update from Kyiv podcast. Thanks to Mr. Smith for our theme music. See you next episode.